If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Welcome to Needle Exchange, conversations on the art of thread. My name's Jamie Chalmers, aka Mr. X Stitch, and in this episode, I sit down with the incredible Bren Ahern, an artist known for his powerful samplers that challenge traditional notions of masculinity, gender, and identity. I've known Bren for over a decade. He was featured in my Push Stitchery book, and so it was great to talk to him. And we dive straight into the conversation with the concept of magnified moments, those small but pivotal experiences that shape us, before we go into Bren's early memories of gendered expectations and how they influenced his work. From the significance of a childhood lunchbox to the subtle ways masculinity is policed, this discussion explores the intersections of personal history and artistic expression. If you enjoyed the episodes with John Thomas Paradis, so that's Needle Exchanges 11 and 12, where we talk about his queer thread connections, you will love this chat with, quite frankly, one of the nicest needleworkers you can hope to meet. So come back next week for part two, where we explore Bren's approach to embroidery, craftivism, and how his work engages with contemporary social issues. And as always, don't forget to subscribe on your favourite podcast platform and check us out, Mr. X Stitch, on Instagram if you aren't already. I'll be back next week, but until then, enjoy the show. I wanted to start by talking about something that you'd mentioned in the past, which is the concept of magnified moments. And I was going to tell you a story about how when I was about seven, and my parents took me to a toy shop, and I was given a choice between a Formula One car that my dad was holding and something like a Mercedes or something that my mum was holding. And I chose the Mercedes because I preferred it, just because it was a better looking car. The thing is my parents got divorced a while later, and I didn't necessarily know that it was coming. But to me, that car-based choice became one of these magnified moments. So when I read about you talking about it, I was just like, oh my God, these insignificant things that happen that get so amplified in our experience that, and we give them these extra gravity. And I know it's something meaningful to you, and I just wanted to get your take on all of it.
That's a wonderful way to start. Arlie Hochschild, she was a professor. I think she's a professor emeritus at University of California, Berkeley. She talks about this idea of magnified moments for those people who aren't familiar with it. She describes them as these moments where things go either superbly well or really horribly wrong. But either way, they just get etched on your consciousness because of just how important the moment is to you. And you mentioned your moment with the Mercedes versus the Formula One. And that I think that shows you have good taste by picking the Mercedes. The magnified moment that you're probably referring to in my work is one where in the US, children carry their lunch to school in a lunchbox. Do you have the same things? In the
UK? Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
What do you call them, a lunchbox?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. And so so for kindergarten, which is our first year of school, we didn't have to bring lunch because it was just a half day of school. But for first grade, my parents brought me to the store. And to their credit, they allowed me to select a flowered lunchbox. And it was a 70s flowered lunchbox in all its green, lime green, orange glory. And but when I brought it to school, I quickly learned that boys should not have flowered lunchboxes. And so I don't know if I hit it or what I did, but I immediately knew that. And so that became etched in my memory. And like I said, to my parents' credit, they allowed me to select this lunchbox without trying to steer me in one direction or another. But for me, why it was so magnified was because this was my first moment in my life where my gender had been policed, how I was performing my gender. And Judith Butler, who's another professor at UC Berkeley, talks about this idea of gender as performance, where we are born a blank slate, but then society places on us how we are to behave. And with your example, with the Formula One versus the Formula One's a very, I'd say, a very masculine kind of beefy kind of car.
Mm, it's all sports, isn't it? It's no comfort.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so so the reason why it's, like I said, the reason why it's magnified for me was because it was my first moment where my gender had been policed and told what to do and what not to do.
Yeah, and it's quite a funny one, isn't it? Because I don't think we don't realize at the time, but I think the fact that these things are so sticky obviously means something. Now, I know as a rational human that my decision did not force my father to move out. There were lots of things that interplayed with it, but I definitely remember it as being a choice that I was making between these two parents. And it was something almost like I'd never had to do before. And I think maybe that's why it stuck so much.
And I forget, what did you say? Did you pick the Mercedes or the Formula?
Yeah. So basically I picked my mum over my dad. And I mean, maybe that's, I don't know. Do you know what I mean? Like Freud's going to have a field day the minute I unpick this. I'll probably start crying in a minute. But it's funny how it works.
And it's weird. It's because how old were you at the time?
6 or 7.
And what a horrible position to put a child in between. But that also shows just how young we are when we are forced into these boxes of how to perform and choices.
Was that, I mean, so for you, that was a profound moment. Was that the first moment that you noted that there was a difference?
Yeah. I mean, I knew girls were girls and boys were boys. Well, of course, that whole binary thing is suspect, given that people are born intersex, there's transgender people and other situations. But I at least knew there were other genders other than boys. But it was the first time that I learned that I had to act a certain way as a boy.
Mm, yeah, and it's funny, isn't it? Because we do, like even my daughter, so I'm a girl dad and I'm very relieved to be a girl dad, but it's interesting when you get the boys wear these colours, girls wear these colours, boys like diggers on their T-shirts and girls like unicorns, and just all of these things that just played out. And then to that point then, you and I both sit in this thing that says embroidery is for girls.
And I actually exploited that idea of embroidery being for girls with my samplers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So let's talk about that. I mean, was that something, because I think you had a moment where embroidery kind of clicked, didn't you? It was, you saw somebody showed you some samplers and that was a real moment as well. Probably a magnified moment upon reflection, but.
I was weaving and then I went back to grad school and I thought to myself, well, I should do embroidery because of the gendered implications of embroidery. But also I thought it would take less time than weaving. And then my husband said, ironically, that my embroideries take just as much time as my weavings. So anyway, to bring it back to your question, I was at school and Barbara Shapiro, who is a, she works in many media. She works in basketry, dyeing, and the like. And she was a teaching assistant at San Francisco State University, where I got my MFA. And she said, oh, you're doing embroidery. You have to see the collection of Marion Sauce, who was this woman who lived down the peninsula from San Francisco. So I went to see her collection. It was really eye-opening. Through seeing her collection and through subsequent research, I learned that embroiderers, samplers and embroidery have had different connotations in different eras, as you know, given your whole background. But for those of you who are listening who may not know, in some cases, for example, with the show Downton Abbey, the daughters, sometimes they would embroider in the living room. So in their class, in their society, in their time, embroidery was a sign of the leisure class. These women did not have to work. But in other times, maybe a few years, 100 years earlier, girls were not afforded an education. So they would learn their ABCs by stitching them onto cloth. And if a family went into service, if a girl went into service for a family, she might bring out her example cloth called a sampler to show the family of her embroidery skills.
Sort of like a CV, wasn't it?
Exactly. And also in some of these samplers, the girls would stitch some sort of saying about how to be a proper girl or proper woman. So this got me thinking about how I've been educated to be a man, a proper man in American society, which ties in with your magnified moment at the beginning, the Formula One versus the Mercedes. And so I decided to just think about this and to document these moments. And so I thought of, and the first thing that came to mind was violence, that American men are socialized to be violent. And my first sampler, which is on the wall behind me, it's an ABC sampler. For those people who don't know, that means I've stitched the ABCs in different alphabets. And then the expression I have on it, it says, when I refuse to fight, I'm called a pussy. And we can see this violence through American society, not only physical violence, but verbal violence with our current president bullying Zelensky of the Ukraine, verbal violence, physical violence. And so it makes me sad. So I'm just making commentary on how I've been educated to be a man in American society. I know that's a long-winded answer.
No. It's a perfect answer. And I want you to go long on all your answers, because quite frankly, I could sit and listen to you talk all day. I think it's fascinating, isn't it? Because I remember discovering your work, let's say 2010, because that was when Push Stitchery came out, I think, and you were in that. And it was understanding that thing about how you were just triangulating your position in society around you and then using these traditional samplers in that same way. And to me, I just saw it. To me, it was one of the earliest examples I'd seen of someone taking a sampler and putting it to contemporary use. And then also you just documenting yourself at certain points. So it's almost, to me, it was like a map of Bren, something like that.
That's interesting, because I had a show at the Bellevue Arts Museum, about 9 or 10 years ago. And the curator, Stefano Catalani, he wrote an article for Surface Design magazine a year or two prior. But he said that my samplers are kind of like diary pages of embarrassing moments. It's because I have other ones where there's one where I'm told by an older female relative to that men have fancier job titles than receptionist. And that made me kind of sad, because this woman was putting herself into a subordinate position. I also realized that she's a product of her generation, where women did not have as many opportunities. But even today, women still do not have as many opportunities as men. So how is that for you, being a father of girls, thinking about that?
It's a weird one. I think I adopt the philosophy that says that by the time, in 10 years' time, when they're 15 and 17, I will be a bit of a wreck, because I'll have two teenage daughters. But more importantly, I feel like the world will have turned. And in some ways, I think with so many of these things, whether it's social media or whatever, there's no point sweating it now, because the game will have changed. You know, I'm pretty sure that in 10 years' time, people will have had to have started paying for Facebook, so it'll probably have died off or some such or other. Do you know what I mean? So, and I guess I believe in human beings. It's hard at the moment, because there's a lot of knuckleheads in being human beings and stuff. But I just think, you know, with my two daughters, I just want them to lean into the skills that they've got. And I don't believe that it would be a gendered discourse, because like Flora wants to be an animal scientist. I think she wants to be a vet, something like that. That's fairly gender neutral. Annie says she wants to be a teaching assistant, but I think she should be a stand-up comedian. Either way, I don't know. I feel grateful to be quite aware of it. Like, weirdly, when I went to uni, I ended up studying psychosocial studies, and that ends up being man's influence on society and society's influence on man, which at the time didn't, I don't know, it was quite an easy subject to do. But having gone into this, you know, needlework is for little old ladies, all of those gender-based stories that we just find ourselves dropped into, it's really interesting to have that slight self-awareness, I think, because so many of these things now, you just learn it's marketing. And I do think arts and crafts, and I do think, you know, men doing these crafts, women do these crafts, it's kind of marketing, but it's marketing that's been around for 250 years. So we kind of take it to be truth, because it's just always been there, you know. And so I just try and just self-correct every now and again, and maybe don't just believe the hype straight away. Just kind of look around and just think, well, it doesn't have to be like that, maybe.
Yeah. And you are an innovator in the field. I mean, you were like the first person to, and I'm so grateful to you for calling attention to my work, because I think, did you find me on Flickr?
Yeah, in the good old days, it would have been Flickr. Yeah, because let's face it, like when we started doing all this, 2008, 2009, it was like you could chat to your friends on Twitter, you could do all this stuff. But yeah, Flickr was definitely the place.
Yeah, I remember when I was in school, I remember it was, I think, 2007 or 2008, and my teacher said, oh, there's this new thing called Flickr, and I think it's going to be kind of big. So I said, okay, I'll just upload some images. And I'm so grateful I did, because I got so many opportunities, including opportunities from you. But in a sense, it seemed a little bit simpler back then, too, in terms of people left nice comments on the work. There wasn't all this negativity online. It also seemed like people just put their work out there. There wasn't as much of a performance associated with putting the work out there. What I mean is, for example, in my algorithm for Instagram, maybe because I'm gay, I don't know, but you see these artists, and they always have these shirtless photos of themselves painting.
Yeah.
And some of them even say, oh, I'm doing this for the algorithm. And so what am I trying to say? I think it's wonderful now because more people have exposure and opportunities to show themselves. But in a sense, I feel it's also harder because a lot of it, there's so much performance involved in it today.
Yeah, it's such a double-edged sword, isn't it? I'm still in the middle of writing a bit of a unit for a course at the Royal School of Needlework are doing, and they've asked me to write about 21st century embroidery. No mean feat. But one of the things I said, like, Instagram is such a game changer because it made it so simple for people to find inspiration. But the flip of it is then we become beholden to these algorithms. I was listening to a podcast this morning, and on that they were saying that the algorithms work in two ways. One of the things is it feeds us stuff that we want to see. But the other thing that it does that we don't realize is it coerces our behavior to make it easy for it to send us stuff. So it sort of modifies by like the For You page or whatever, you know, it shows you all this stuff. And over time, it just modifies that to make you easier to just fit into these categories or something. And that's like the stealthy way that we don't realize. So we are, you know, I remember with Instagram, it would be like, it was just okay to do images. And then suddenly, because TikTok came along, you had to do videos. And if you didn't do videos, people were just falling down. And now it's not, you just got to do videos. Like you say, you got to do videos with your top off, which is not good as far as I'm concerned. But then it's whatever's next, isn't it? And it's just that it sort of, again, pulls away the need for us as people, humans. We have to become products. We have to become brands. We have to market ourselves and play that game. And I personally am so grateful to be a curator rather than a creator, because I don't even have to do that. We just keep showing nice things that other people are doing, you know. But it is, we're being just tugged along, aren't we?
Yeah, and I started actually about 2017 or so. I kind of started to drop off the map for a number of reasons. One was that I had a big show at a museum, and the curator left, and I talked to the museum about shopping the show around, and they didn't have the staff to shop it around. And then I started a new job where I worked all the time. And so I didn't really have time to start putting myself out there. And then I just kind of said, well, it's kind of a hassle to put yourself out there. And so I also see the effect, too, where I've dropped off. I haven't been showing. I've been showing hardly at all. And that's why I'm so grateful to you for saying, hey, let's chat today. But I'm still been creating. But I just have kind of, I don't know what to say, given up on the marketing. I've just kind of have been tired of it, doing the marketing.
Yeah, it's been really interesting for us as well, because obviously I started the blog in 2008, and now I look around at the world of like AI search and all those sorts of things where people don't even visit blogs. So it's almost like having to rethink that whole process and having to realize that the best way to market, from my standpoint, from a marketing standpoint now, it's email marketing, because that's like permission marketing. That's where people have said, I want to hear from you. And so you can communicate directly with them. And you're not beholden to, you know, the whims of the different like big tech companies and stuff like that. But I think that the other thing I've had, and this might make sense, is I used to listen to a couple of podcasts, Arrest is Politics US. And I decided at the start of the new year to stop doing that, because I just found that about twice a week for 2 hours a week, it was making me annoyed. And I was like, I don't need to do that, you know. And I think there's something there, isn't there, that if we find ourselves just, the beauty is in the making, the beauty is in the storytelling, the beauty is in the creative act, and it's the creative act that we're meant to do, not the creative act that then we're forced to do as a byproduct of trying to do the first one. Do you know what I mean? I think we owe it to ourselves to peel away those layers and just do the thing that we're meant to do, not the thing we're told to do.
Yeah, which is hard, because even before this whole social media landscape, I think it was even hard to realize what that is, what we're meant to do.
Mm.
Why do I say that? I think because, also the tradition of needlework too, with this perfection. When I had a show at the Bellevue Arts Museum, I was giving a tour to the docents before the show opened. And I said, do you want to see the back? And they said, yeah, yeah. So I showed the back and one of the docents said, oh, well, I see that all of your stitches in the back are horizontal and vertical instead of all vertical. And so in a way, I feel as though she was trying to put me in my place. She just kind of acted as, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And so that's why I'm grateful to you for just showing innovative artists who are breaking the rules or still following, in some cases, still following the rules, but just doing it in innovative ways.
They're all those layers, though, aren't they? That's just another layer of how things should be according to external critique or something. Do you know what I mean? Because it doesn't matter what the back of the work looks like. I think there's a skill, you know, and it's like saying Japanese embroidery, all the stitches have to be perfect. That's Japanese embroidery. But cross-stitch by a 10-year-old can be whatever the hell it likes on the back. And it's only, I always used to say, it's the same. It's just a gender socio-political discourse. I always used to say as well that like people who were really nitpicky about how the back of your work should look are just angry because you're younger than they are and they're staring death in the face, which is it's very much a paraphrase. But do you know what I mean? It's like a lot of this stuff is tricky because some people come from a position, I think, where they want you to be better at your craft because that's craftsmanship. But it's like it is just that critique, isn't it? It's something we all face. I mean, I figure that's something that you've been bouncing along ever since you became self-aware of all that kind of stuff. Is that fair?
Yeah, yeah. And interestingly enough, which I don't know why I didn't say this to her, but a reason why I do, especially my big samplers, actually all my samplers, but how do I put this so the listeners can understand? For my big samplers, I go up one hole and over three holes. I'm using Aida cloth. I'm sorry. Aida cloth. I go up one hole. I cross over. I go over three holes and then go in the fourth hole.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I have all of my stitches on the back in a vertical direction, there's a lot of take up. So it pulls up the fabric. It bunches up the fabric.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I vary it.
It's like smocking or something, isn't it? You're using it from a structural standpoint.
Exactly. Yeah.
Take that, lady.
But that kind of made me sad because that kind of ties in with that whole thing I was talking about, that other sampler where the person told me that men have fancy job titles. It's not the same thing, but this whole idea of setting these limits on oneself that can be detrimental.
Mm. Yeah.
Which I don't like.
Why do we do that? I mean, you've done, how many samplers have you done?
Good. I think I've done about 20 or so far.
And they've always been big as well, haven't they?
No, well, the one behind me, that's small. I have about maybe four or five small ones. And then when I was in school, I was like, well, I guess I'll do big samplers.
I mean, for the listeners, that's still like, what, A3 size? It's not small as in 4 inches or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so it's about half a meter by, I don't know, yeah, like a third of a meter or something. Yeah, yeah. But the reason why I started the big ones, because I was in school and they said, you have to do something different. So I was like, oh, I'll try big samplers. And now that I'm older, it's kind of nice since I have arthritis. And so the stitches are easier to make.
How long would one of your big samplers, I mean, you're sitting there, you just do it with it like draped over your lap, like it's some kind of massive thing, or do you sit in a frame and do it properly with proper posture and all those kind of things?
What do you think? I actually have a table here and most of them are on Aida cloth and Aida cloth has sizing. So it's stiff. So I tend to work outside in without a hoop or a frame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you sit there. And then, because the other question I was going to ask is this idea of when you're doing a piece about a subject, you dwell on the subject. If you're doing big pieces, like for instance, the one behind you, where, you know, when you refuse to fight, you're called a pussy. Now, how long do you spend dwelling on that subject when you're making it? Or can you shortcut yourself by doing all of the letters and you don't have to think about the subject matter in any great depth? Or do you literally spend like 60 hours pondering on that? And how would you come out the other side of it?
What I do is I spend 60 hours pondering just, oh, this is taking forever. So I'm actually kind of divorced from the subject. I mean, I map it out using a software like MacStitch or something like that. And then I go to it. So when I'm actually stitching, I'm not really thinking that much about the subject. I'm listening to podcasts. I'm listening to music. And I'm just kind of, I wouldn't say resentful. I'm just kind of tired of the piece by the time I finish it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can't appreciate it until maybe a couple of months after I finished it.
Right. Yeah. So is it more that the thought goes in at the planning stage in that case then?
Exactly, yeah.
Right. And how do you, like, because the other thing is, yeah, you're very much still, I believe, playing with the traditional sampler style. You're going for that very simplistic approach. Is that something that's important to you? Because you've definitely kind of stuck there.
Yeah. The reason why I've been working with this is because I view it as like three things kind of informing each other. The embroidery, quote, women's work, the sampler form, which has been used by girls and women to reinforce femininity, and I think the message, and then the sampler form actually has messages of femininity, so they all kind of reinforce each other. So I think that's kind of why I've been working with there. When I was in school, my teacher suggested I be freer, and I had a couple samplers kind of in the style of Tillica Schwartz.
Mm-hmm.
And but to me, they just all look like Tillica Schwartz's ripoffs. And so, I guess also I'm kind of known for this kind of sampler too. So it's kind of my calling card too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your sort of signature style. It's interesting, isn't it? Because you just don't see modern samplers. I remember once back in like 2010, someone did one that was like a Cthulhu sampler. And I was like, well, there's a different line of thought. It's not, I mean, maybe I'm wrong. This is random, but I think that style of needlework is becoming quite an American style of needlework. Like when I look around on Etsy and I see some people that sort of leaning into the tradition, those little house style ones, the people, there is a vernacular that seems to be evolving that's of a sort of 1800s Americana sort of vibe or something like that, which is interesting because I see that hanging on in a way. I don't have my fingers on the pulse of all the English cross stitch, but I think that people aren't doing those traditional flavors in the same way, which it seems to be hanging on as though that is a bit of an Americana thing. Would you agree?
I agree. And when I first started doing them, I was living in San Francisco. Now I'm on the West Coast, and now I'm in Philadelphia on the East Coast. And someone in my graduate program, she said, "Are you from the East Coast?" I said, "Yeah, how'd you know?" She said, "Well, she grew up in, I think, New York or somewhere." And she said, "Yeah, it's very East Coast what you're doing." And so I didn't even realize that I was, I guess, paying testament to my own history.
Hmm. Yeah, because it's interesting because I think America's history is so comparatively new, obviously, because we've got such a rich history in England.
Yeah.
But I think quilts and that style of cross-stitch to me feel like they are becoming somewhat iconic in that kind of handmade arena.
Yeah.
I'm always a bit baffled by the Nashville needlework market as well. That whole thing where people issue patterns and stuff, which again, largely seem to be leaning into that traditional style, you know? There's a lady called the Artsy Housewife who I absolutely love because she's doing the tradition, but she's keeping it kind of weird. Like one of her designs was of a brown bear with a plant pot on his head filled with flowers or something, but in that traditional style. And again, it's like original thinking, but I'm still kind of just, I don't know, waiting to see people, because it's rich for the exploitation, I think, that particular media.
One thing I've gotten away from, well, actually, two things. One is my most recent sampler. I don't know if you've seen it. It's a really huge sampler. I think it's sampler number 19. That's actually not my most recent. Sampler number 19, which is still in progress. It's 60 inches tall. So about, what's that, about a meter and a half tall by, I don't know, 600 inches or something like that. So it's kind of a greatest hits sampler, right? I've been kind of taking these motifs from my various other samplers and putting them on. So that's still kind of in that same realm. It's somewhat kind of traditional, a little bit different.
It's got music on it, isn't it?
Yeah, there's music on it. Yeah. Another way I've been doing something a little bit different in terms of the actual needlework is I've been working with active shooter situations.
Well, yes. That's quite the subject. I was going to come on to that because that's what's interesting, I think, is then when you look at, for instance, the work you did most recently with the pennant shapes and the skulls and stuff, it is quite different. I feel like they're both almost like palette cleansers from one another because the other ones are very vibrant, aren't they? You're leaning into that kind of skull motif. Talk about that project because, again, this is one of those times where I'm a bit grateful that I live in England and we have something like gun control or whatever. But please just tell me all about it.
Yeah, when I worked at the University of California at Davis, they called all the medical students and the staff, I was a staff member, into the auditorium, and the police told us what to do if someone comes in and, with a gun and tries to kill us all. And at the end, they gave us this handy little index card, about a 3x5-inch card with all these directions on it of what to do if we were in that situation. I thought, well, this is crazy, as if I'm going to whip out this card.
Hang on a minute, don't shoot, just got to get my card.
Exactly. And so I stitched a supersized version of that. That was in 2011. And it was very wordy, the card that they gave us. That's another thing, as if you're going to read all these words too. And so I subsequently learned that the Department of Homeland Security of the U.S., they issued simpler instructions. Run, hide, fight. As a first thing you should try to do is to run if you're in that situation. If you can't do that, then you should hide. And as a last resort, you should fight. So I've stitched supersized versions of just these three words, run, hide, fight, in various fonts. So to me, that kind of is a next generation sampler, because have you seen that piece, those pieces?
Yeah.
So it's kind of a next generation sampler because it's kind of harkening back to old needlework samplers, the different fonts. In a sense, perhaps they're a bit more sampler-like than my actual samplers, because I'm just playing with different fonts. They're planned, but they're, I think, a bit more spontaneous than my samplers.
It's almost like they're a version of something like Eat, Pray, Sleep or something.
Exactly. Yeah. And then more recently, I moved to Philadelphia in 2021 to be closer to my mother in her last years of her life. And I started taking screen printing at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. And so I decided I wanted to do a pennant for each school in the U.S. at which there's been a school shooting in the college of that school. And so that's the project you were referring to with the pennants. And so I've done a pendant for each school, and then I've tacked them onto a piece of duck cloth in a circle. So it's 16 pendants per circle. And then each circle is kind of put onto a piece of acrylic, and there's a French cleat on the back, which is attached to the wall. So it's about an inch or so from the wall. That's probably TMI. But yeah, when I showed it at my screen printing class, the teacher had a lot to say about it. He said that to him, it also evokes kind of the Wheel of Fortune, which they talk about in Shakespeare, kind of the Wheel of Fortune goes around. You don't know where it's going to end up. I never knew about this until I took Shakespeare at university. I just thought it was a TV show.
Yeah, right. The Wheel of Fortune.
And he also said, you know, the carnival Wheel of Fortune. I just did not realize all of this historic references. He said, you don't know if you're going to get shot or not. And so he said they also look like targets, my circles. So what's your take? Any thoughts?
I think there's a few different things. It was making me think. I had Betsy Greer on a few episodes ago, and we were talking about craftivism and sort of the reality of craftivism, because I think there's this contrast sometimes where people think if I do a cross stitch that says, you know, save the planet, it's going to change people's minds about CO2 and stuff. And it's just, the scale just doesn't fit. It really doesn't, isn't it? Because for all the individual work we can do, China's going to still belch out coal, CO2. Yeah. So it makes me wonder in some ways about the validity or the need for it, because I see it as an infographic and I see it as a way of enlightening people to the numbers. You know, again, we don't have it over here, but I'm pretty sure you guys get about a third of the way into the year, and then there have been more shootings than there have been days in the year or something. Tragic, isn't it? It's those kind of stats.
Mm-hmm.
So I recognize that you're doing those kind of infographics, and then it's trying to understand what the purpose is. And I wonder whether the value of the work is internal for you, or whether there is an external thing of it being a statement piece that can be shown to people to try and forward on the debate.
Yeah, that's interesting you mentioned about the whole craftivism, because I was asked about that in another interview about activism, and I don't really view myself as an activist. I view myself kind of as a presenter of information, as you mentioned, because I feel as though also in some instances of craftivism that one can alienate like half the country depending upon what is stated on the piece. So from my pieces, I just try to present the work. For example, I'm just presenting, oh, these are the number of schools where there have been school shootings. Like with my samplers, this is my own experience. I'm not saying that's your experience, that's my experience. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying this is what happened. So what are your thoughts about kind of craftivism? You mentioned about, what are your thoughts about when someone explicitly says bad, bad, bad?
I think if it gets out of their system, then maybe that's okay. You know, I think if 10 years down the line, they're still saying bad, 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 then I feel like maybe they haven't learned or evolved. I think with any messages that we do, it's a bit like swear we crossed it. You know, it serves a purpose. It gets you somewhere. But if you're still repeating the same things over and over again, I don't feel like you're particularly learning something. I think we have things here like there was this protesters, what they call Just Stop Oil, and they're talking about like climate change and those kind of things. Very valid. But they'll do things like have protests in where they sit down over a motorway and stop all the traffic. And I remember listening to this book that was called The Pitch by a guy called Oren Claff. And it says, whenever someone presents an argument to us, our primitive brain kicks in first and tries to get rid of it. So when someone blocks off a motorway and inconveniences loads of people, all they're really doing is just pissing off loads of people. They're not, no one in that, it's, who sat in that traffic is going to go, oh, actually, yeah, I think I should have taken, I should have cycled to work. Well, it doesn't work. It's a bold action, but all it does is it disenfranchises people. And I think the same thing when people say bad, 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 after a while, you're just like, okay, I get the message, but what's good? Or, you know, how can we have a more enlightened debate? Because we can't just use blunt force trauma on these things. One of the things I appreciate about your work is it's quite light touch. So, for instance, with your samplers and with those pieces, with the penance, they're statements of fact that are presented. You don't then have a video going, and this is the reason why you should think a certain way. You just present that information. And I think a bit like abstract art in some ways, it offers it up to the reader or the viewer to form their own conclusions. And that's probably about as best as we could ever hope.
Yeah, I'm just trying to open a dialogue rather than shut down a dialogue.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing, because, you know, it seems a modern thing these days as well, that if you think a certain way, then you must therefore think loads of other ways. You know, this short-sighted view that is promulgated on social media that says, you know, if you vote Republican, these are the things you believe. And there's no, like, you can be a little bit of both or any of those kind of things. Whereas I think humans, given half the chance, do think lots of different things about lots of different ways. And our courses correct over time or change, don't they? The older you become, I think you probably become naturally more conservative with a small c. I don't know, risk averse or whatever.
I think I've become more liberal, but that's another story. But you're right, just this idea of opening a dialogue, it's important. There's now there's no room for nuance in a lot of situations, which makes me sad.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NEEDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needle exchange. See you next time.